It was over in just 48 hours. A tidal wave of opposition to the European Super League swept across the continent. The attempted breakaway of 12 clubs, including the English Big Six, to form their own competition, which they could never be relegated from, sparked almost universal revulsion, and its demise was hailed as a victory for football and for basic fairness. But what does this episode tell us about modern football? Is the revamped Champions League any better? And are there any hopes of the game being returned to the fans? Today we grill someone who has been at the heart of football's commercial transformation about the future of the beautiful game.
There have been reports all day that 12 of the major European clubs are looking to form a breakaway European Super League.
Those top six clubs who have agreed to this want more money. I just think it's absolutely disgusting.
Manchester United, 100 years, born out of workers around here. And they're breaking away into a league without competition that they can't be relegated from. It's an absolute disgrace.
This is, for me, a war on football.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host, Zoe Williams. Our guest today is David Cogan, the Premier League's media rights advisor from 1988 to 2015. He has been described as a key architect of its financial success. But away from big money football, David is also a figure in Labour politics. His 2019 book, Protest and Power, The Battle for the Labour Party, chronicles the history of the party's many factional conflicts over its soul and direction. We'll be picking his brains on whether the big money revolution in football has gone too far. You can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then. But that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
David, imagining that we're as clueless as we could possibly be, but we're just ardent, hard lefties, and we saw the overturning of the European Super League as a triumph of the fan over the international jet set. Can you just explain what exactly happened and whether that's right or wrong?
Well, I think what we've seen in the last 2 weeks is actually a set of changes within football, most of which actually were predictable, but all of which have happened at once. And there was the overturning of the European Super League by six clubs from the Premiership and six others in Europe. There's also actually almost as significant the idea that the Premier League is now going to roll its media rights deals over the next 3 years without going to markets and without competition, which is actually the first time it's ever done that. You've also got the Champions League that's also changed its format, which is going to have a huge bearing on things like clubs in the EFL, which hasn't really been talked about. And now you've also got the acquisition of BT Sport, who own some of the Premier League rights, by a new third party. And all of that in the world of football is revolutionary. The point about the European Super League is that for years, the seeds of this have been building up by overseas owners, and particularly owners from America who are used to the NFL, which is a closed system, by the new thing, which is merchant banks and hedge funds now moving into football as a principal sponsor. They've already done it in rugby. They're now beginning to do it in football. And that is a new event because it's the first time billions of pounds are coming in from that source. And therefore, the chief motivator in football, which is always money, got kind of put on steroids. How far was it that the fans had an effect on stopping this? They clearly had an effect, but then so did government action, so did the response actually of the football authorities. And so did actually the naivety of the people setting up the European Super League in the first place, which certainly was a contributing factor. So I don't really see this as being the fans entirely who did it. I think there's a whole series of factors that led to it being stopped. The really interesting question will be what effect it has in a year's time, because at the moment, it's all churning around.
You say it was the naivety on behalf of the people setting up the European Super League. And I can sort of grasp who that would have been. But do you agree with the Gary Neville diatribe that I think we all saw on Twitter, that this was just fueled by pure greed? Or do you think it seemed to them, maybe part of the reason they were so naive is because it just seemed like an obvious next move to them?
I actually saw Gary Neville's rant live on television rather than on Twitter afterwards. And, you know, a lot of what he said was right. I mean, a lot of what he said was this is clearly motivated by greed. But then football, and I should say professional football players with agents, are not entirely devoid of greed. That's hardly a new event within the world of football. The reason I was talking about naivety was that if you were going to set up this league in the way they were trying to do it, you wouldn't have done it based on the principles of American sport rather than UK sport, i.e. competition versus a closed league. You would have certainly set up, you know, the media deals prior to launching it. You wouldn't have got rushed into it, and you wouldn't have fought such a lousy PR campaign. So in that sense, they were naive. But in terms of your question about, you know, is this the natural consequence of what's been going on in football for the last 35 years? It was certainly something that a lot of people in football have been seeing as a threat. What was interesting was the timing in that they enacted the threat, but it's been threatened many times before.
Yeah, because I remember this conversation. I don't know what the origin point of it, but there's been talk about a European breakaway by the top clubs for over 20 years, I think. And it seemed from the outside anyway, that it was always a negotiating tactic to try and get more cash, more revenue, a bit of a drive to extract as much as they could from UEFA and so on. Was it different this time? Was it like a real plausible bid to exit? And what made it different? What made them bite the bullet?
I mean, you're absolutely right. It's been talked about for 20 years and used as a gun. What most people didn't realise was that 2 or 3 years ago within the Premier League, the Founders Agreement, which conditioned how money went to all 20 clubs, got changed by the big six clubs so that they got more of the overseas revenues than they had done before. And that was with the threat of forming a European Super League if the other clubs didn't agree. So they've been using sort of blackmail for quite a long time, and this has been the particular weapon in the blackmail. Where this was different was two things. First of all, they had bullied and pressurized UEFA into almost giving them everything they wanted. In fact, the new changes to the Champions League, which sort of got lost in the whole story, are in many ways as dangerous as anything European Super League wanted to do. And we can talk about that in a minute, if you like. But the fact is, having pushed UEFA to giving them more control, more money, the automatic right for a couple of clubs to get into the Champions League without going through the normal competition, all of that UEFA has now conceded, more clubs in the Champions League, all of that UEFA has conceded. Despite that, and despite the fact that week prior to the weekend when the story broke, them assuring UEFA that they were going to go along with UEFA's master plan, they ditched UEFA's master plan and went on their own that weekend. They'd clearly been planning that for some time. So it wasn't just the greed that they displayed. They also displayed a fairly high level of duplicity. But the real point was it wasn't a negotiating tactic this time. This time was different. And why was it different? Because JP Morgan put up £6 billion. And the reason why it was different is, i.e. the money, is because, to be blunt, and I have to say, you know, lucky for me, most people don't bother following in football the contractual and financial side of what's going on. They look at the emotion. They look at, you know, all the stuff that happens on the pitch. They're all fans. I'm a fan. Very few people actually bother getting into the actual detail of what was going on. And I mean, to give you an example of that, one of the things that was interesting about the European Super League is that it wanted to cap agents' fees. Now, I have worked in football for a long time, and I can remember arguing times blue in the face with clubs after we delivered huge amounts of money in media deals that this was the time not to pay huge amounts of money to agents. Forget players, it's agents who take the real money, right? this time it looked like the 12 clubs, if you read the small print that they put out while they were still an active league for those 48 hours, they were talking about capping agents' fees and capping expenditure by clubs. So they were actually doing some things that actually quite a lot of people have wanted them to do in English football for quite a long time.
It's baffling because as you say, most people do follow the emotion and not the contract. But nevertheless, you'd think if the fundamental reason it were different was because there was this £6 billion invested that wasn't there before, that would be the top line. But that is not the top line as far as I've seen it.
Well, you know, it de-risked the move. Remember, the risk taking if they didn't have the big finance was that they were able to create an alternative competition to Champions League and get what was the other form of funding, which are television deal, broadcast deals, global rights deals, all sorts of things. But actually, in this instance, they didn't necessarily need to do that in the short term because they were getting all this money from JP Morgan, which would have justified them making the move. I mean, what it proves to me is, and I have to say this is the case in rugby at the moment as well, where another hedge fund is heavily invested in rugby, the due diligence needed by these banks coming in sport is not necessarily particularly expert because, you know, sport is, as we've just seen, a very strange beast which works in a very strange way and has very strange economics.
I just wondered if you could give us the inside track on what's going to happen to the UEFA changes now. I mean, are they just going to be nodded through, or is there a discussion amongst UEFA and the associations in Europe in light of the backlash against the European Super League to say, hang on a minute, do we need to reconsider any of these format changes for the Champions League?
It's a very good question, Luke, but unfortunately that horse has more than truly bolted. One of the things that people don't seem to have understood is that both the Premier League and the FA in England voted through the UEFA changes in January, and they were voted through on the Monday that the European Super League was basically being debated in public. UEFA went ahead. Those changes have happened. The format changes have happened, and all the concomitant effects of those have happened. And, you know, let me just explain, if I can, the effect on English football, because it might just be useful to kind of explain this, right?
Yeah.
You have pyramids in English football where you have the national game, the sort of amateur game, which gets about £1 million a year in television money. Then you now have the Women's Super League, which I just negotiated, in fact, which went from zero to between, let's say, 5 and 10 million a year. I can't give the actual number because we haven't publicised it. You've then got Scottish football, Scottish Premier League, which I used to represent, which gets about 30 million a year. And then you've got the EFL, as it's now called, which gets about 120 million in broadcasting revenue a year from Sky. And then you've got the Premier League. So you've got this pyramid with huge leaps. The EFL, which is 72 clubs, a lot of whom are in deep trouble, a lot of whom are in, you know, very interesting seats, parliamentary seats, because a lot of them are in the red wall seats, Wigan being an interesting example, Bury, Oldham. A lot of these seats actually are for these clubs that are in some financial trouble, quite a few of whom got overseas owners. And what they depend on, and that television money, most of that television money, and I used to negotiate that money, is based around what we used to call the League Cup and is now the Carabao Cup, in which Man City and Spurs played the final last week. Once you get a change to the Champions League format, which has gone through, and more clubs from the Premiership will be in the Champions League because there'll be more games. They're going to 10 games around. That means there are fewer television slots and fewer ability slots to play those matches in the League Cup. So more and more Premier League clubs will stop playing in the League Cup. And if once they stop playing in the League Cup, there will be no money coming forward from broadcasters to pay for it. And at that point, the economic turmoil of clubs beneath the Premier League, which is already intense, will become unbelievably intense and probably terminal for a lot of them. So what UEFA has done with the full agreement of the FA and the Premier League has basically rigged it so that the clubs lower down the pyramid will probably end up getting far less television money over the course of the next 5 years, just at the same time as the Premier League itself is just rolling on the deals it's already got. So the gap between the Premier League and the EFL is going to get wider, and the money going to clubs, particularly in Leagues 1 and Leagues 2, will drop dramatically in terms of television money.
Can we go back to the beginning? How did you end up negotiating media rights for the Premier League?
So I, as you probably, I was managing director of Reuters Television, which was the biggest global television news agency in its time. I was there from the mid-80s to the mid-90s, which is an amazing period for foreign news. Obviously, you know, Berlin Wall, Yugoslavia, extraordinary stories, extraordinary times. And I left Reuters and set up my own company, which with a business partner, and at the time, just as digital was being launched in the UK, so Sky went from 100 to 1,000 channels, that sort of thing, on digital, as it was known, got launched. And lots of broadcasters wanted to launch television channels, people like Channel 4, and we worked on launching those channels and basically did lots and lots of deals around those channels and other things. And one day, a year after we set up the company, in November the 1st, 1999, the phone rang and his voice said, "Hello, my name's Richard Scudamore. Last week, I was appointed chief executive of the Premier League. I wonder if you'd like to come in and pitch to be our media rights advisor." To which I said, I come from news, not sports. I've no interest at all in working in football. Goodbye." And put the phone down on him. And he called back, luckily, and said, "We'd really like you." By then, we had a company of three people. "We'd like you to come in and pitch against McKinsey and Bain and all the others, IMG." And my business partner and I, who knew nothing about sport, wrote a presentation about actually what was important, which wasn't sport. It was the broadcasters bidding for sports, and particularly bidding for the Premier League, and how you'd set up creative solutions to the launch of 3G, which happened that year, and how you put pressure on Sky, which then had exclusivity over Premier League rights. And we came up with this idea of how to do that. And to our utter astonishment, we got hired. And that led to six Premier League deals, five EFL deals, three or four Scottish Premier League deals, Premier Rugby, Six Nations, and the Olympic Games, the NFL, and a whole bunch of other things. Pure luck.
I know you've explained a little bit of this already, but do you have a date that you'd mark as the beginning of the big money takeover of football? And why would you choose that date? Or would you say it's much more incremental?
Well, I'd say it's incremental. It depends how you define big money. I mean, let's take Manchester United just as a working example, right? Manchester United was bought by a local butcher called Louis Edwards in the 60s. You know, he was a local businessman. Most clubs were owned by local businessmen in the old First Division. And, you know, they made a little bit of money here and there by being in the club. But they were basically buying it to reinforce their position as local tradesmen. And you go into the 70s and the 80s, and by then, you have English football in terrible trouble. I mean, one of the things that people forget about the creation of the Premier League was, I mean, I'm old enough to remember going to football stadia in the 70s, which was rough. And then you had, you know, the English clubs being banned from Europe after Heysel. You had stadia disasters here, Hillsborough and the others. And it was obvious that you needed, and in fact, even Margaret Thatcher recognised that you needed a complete transformation of English football for it to be safe and reasonable. And that led to the idea that you might get some more money coming into it, which led in turn to the creation of the Premier League, which was essentially a walk away from the Football League. And when the Premier League was created, and Sky had only been created a couple of years before it, in 1989, Sky saw it as a huge opportunity. Rupert Murdoch saw it as a huge opportunity because he'd used sport in other parts of his empire to drive subscriptions in the case of Sky. So suddenly Sky, which had only really just been started, came in famously with a massive bid to buy Premier League rights. So you can say that was the start, really, of the big money coming in. But of course, the money that... But when I first sold the Premier League's rights in 2000, I think the previous deal had been something like 660 million over 3 or 4 years. Today, it's 10.3 billion, I think, from memory, over 3 years. That's been that sort of increase. So two things really happened. The first was lots more television money came in, thanks to people like me. And the second thing was big overseas owners started buying clubs. And I think, in my own view, is that changed not only the financing of football, but the culture of football. And what we actually saw over the last 2 or 3 weeks was that culture change really being almost more clearly seen for the first time than the money. The money's always been there. Yeah. And players, as well as others, have enjoyed the benefits of that.
And I suppose on that note, I mean, if this European Super League had been proposed in 1990, I mean, it seems quite unlikely that it would have had six clubs from the English Premier League. I mean, I believe we were, if memory serves, still banned from European competition in 1990. But so is it a sign of the success of English football that we now would dominate this hypothetical, it hasn't happened, European Super League? Or is it a sign that in a way we've led to the financialisation that is going to cause a problem for the rest of the European game?
Well, I'm probably going to have a slightly different view to yours on this, because in my view, if you look at the way the Premier League developed over the last 25 years, and there's lots of stuff we can talk about, including the fit and proper person test for ownership, which is not, in my view, particularly good within the Premier League. But one thing I do believe is good is this. The Premier League wasn't just an English league. The Premier League was really an international league. And if you look at the money that was spent on players, bringing the best players in the world to, you know, English football, if you look at the stadia that have been built in the last 20 years, none of that would have happened, none of it, without the Premier League going out and getting those television deals. None of it. And I personally think that is to the good of the English game, and it's to the good of the fans' experience. What I think is less good is the way the clubs, despite getting all the money from things I used to do, also then proceeded to fleece the fans for all sorts of other reasons, such as on ticket prices and on merchandise and the rest of it. And we can talk about that. But the truth is that English football isn't the success story it is by luck. You know, it's there by the fact that it was and is the best in the world. And I'm not saying that because I'm party prig. If you take the example of the Spanish League, for years had two clubs in it that took almost all the television money, obviously Real and Barcelona. The rest of the clubs were starved of cash. It wasn't a competitive league. One of the things that they got wrong 2 weeks ago was they misunderstood the nature of competition. The reason that in Singapore and Thailand and, you know, 188 territories take the Premier League, the reason for that is, one, fans overseas associating with individual club brands, and two, the league is inherently competitive. It's a great product. And you know something? I'm a fan. I've been a Spurs fan since 1963, you know, and that's when I first went to White Hart Lane. And it breaks your heart being a Spurs fan. It always does. But the fact is, what has happened to Tottenham in terms of its stadium, in terms of its team, has been, you know, a great thing. Unfortunately, we can't win anything, but that's beside the point for this point I'm making. So, you know, I accept this idea. You're talking about the monetization, the financialization of football. I would argue that if you had the choice of going to a football match today and going to a football match in 1975, like I used to have to, you'd opt for today's experience rather than 1975.
So on JP Morgan's projections for the European Super League, was it really worth the bang for their buck, the billions that they were going to throw in?
Well, I'd love to know what their financial projections were, because I can't believe they were particularly well done. I mean, you know, I've done countless business plans and financial projections over the years about predicting the future of sports and sports rights. And I have to assume they went in with the happy belief that if you had a sort of monopolist position within this league, and you never had relegation and you never had promotion, and you have put the clubs into 23-year deals, which again, I don't think people quite realize. JP Morgan was basically doing an asset play. It was tying these assets in over the very long term. And actually, if you look at 6 billion over the course of 23 years, I'd say that's a pretty cheap investment, actually, assuming that they could then go on and monetize this new league. And the way you monetize it is by selling rights across the world, all sorts of digital platforms. And the way that clubs would have monetized it was also having their own club product channels, digital channels going into China and things like that. So they all thought they could have several bites of the media cherry, shall we say. And JP Morgan, 6 billion over long-term contracts, 23 years. I don't think that's a particularly high investment, actually. And if they'd got the media deals, they'd have got a return on their money. It just happened to be totally ill-conceived, which is the bit they missed.
And the other side of this is that a lot of the clubs, Real Madrid, Barcelona, despite, as you mentioned, hoovering up money from the Spanish league, I mean, they're in a huge amount of debt. Now, one argument you hear is that, well, look, that where is that money going? Well, they're paying players astronomical wages, so how, and agents astronomical amounts too. So does there need to be a reckoning at that side of the game? I mean, it's interesting, of course, that players have been some of the most angry, and rightly so, of course, indignant people about this whole European Super League project. But of course, in some quarters, the finger is being pointed at them in terms of greed in the game too.
Well, as I said earlier, one of the things that's remarkable about the European Super League is they wanted to cap agents' fees. And it's the first time I've seen anyone in football suggest doing that. I bet you that came from JP Morgan, because that would have been an obvious piece of financial management, which no one's had the effrontery to suggest so far within English football, that some might argue that they should. So, yeah, I mean, I listened to all the outrage of all the players, and it'd be interesting to know what Gary Neville's sort of salary was over the course of the time that he was a player and where he thought that money was coming from. As I say, nobody wants football to go back to 1975. I think that's a different issue, the amount of money coming into football, as to who owns the clubs and what they were trying to do. And I think these issues all got mixed up over the course of the last 3 or 4 weeks, because, you know, agents' fees has been an issue that football could have dealt with. I'll tell you a true story, that on one year, every year there's a summer meeting of Premier League clubs, and I used to get invited to it as the guy who'd been negotiating the deals. And one year we did a particularly spectacular deal. The chief executive of a very well-known football club, in fact, one of the six, so this chief executive no longer works in football, came up to me and said, "Well, thanks a lot." And I said, "You sound as though you're being sarcastic." And he said, "I am. No, it just means I'm going to have to pay agents even more." And I said, "Well, why don't you not pay agents even more?" And he looked at me and just laughed and said, "Because if I don't pay them, others here will."
Classic.
It was mutually assured destruction. Mm. And I think it's interesting. The European Super League discovered that actually the moment had come to stop the mutually assured destruction. I mean, and that's one measure that maybe others will now look at.
So, we don't often talk about sport on this show, but we do talk a lot about authoritarianism and how it's rising globally. And some English football club owners do have some shady connections. Chelsea's Abramovich is said to be good friends with Vladimir Putin, for example. I wish from the curve upwards of my voice, I had more examples, but I have got the sense that they're all well dodged. There seems to be an acceptance that this is just the way of the world. Money's king and it doesn't matter who's got it. What do you think of that reading?
Well, you certainly managed to wrap a whole bunch of things into that question. I'm not on any owner of any football club. I have no idea what connections they have. I think it is quite clear that the fit and proper person test, as it's known, which both the Premier League and the EFL apply to who can buy clubs, is going to be something that's going to be subject to this Tracy Crouch review, about which we actually know very little at the moment. But it certainly ought to be, because, you know, there have been all sorts of examples. I mean, if you look at just the number and range of people who bought football clubs in the last few years, some of them have put lots of money into those clubs, some of them put no money into those clubs and just walked away with the asset. And the way in which the Premier League and indeed the EFL is self-regulated on who can buy into clubs. And this is where I do think the fan argument, I mean, you haven't asked me about this, but the countervailing argument that you need fan representation on boards, I think is absolutely right. I mean, what you have to have are clear guidelines as to who can buy what are major cultural institutions in this country. If you are in a town which has in it, you know, a football club dominating the town, and a lot of these sort of northern industrial towns in the Red Wall seats have those football clubs, they're major parts of the kind of culture of the town, and somebody comes in and buys one, they need to be checked out in a way that's effective, and there needs to be a proper regulated check on who can buy. But you also need fan representation on the board. Personally, I don't agree with 50+1. Because, you know, I think that will probably mean you get far less money coming into football, which is necessary. But I do believe that you need to have fans on the board. And I do believe there needs to be a much more highly regulated process by which people are checked out. And there are countless examples of people coming in and buying clubs and then leaving them adrift, and those clubs being on the point of bankruptcy. And there are at least 20 to 30 clubs in that state at the moment.
So, I mean, that's the kind of follow-up question, really, is how do fans take back control, to coin a phrase? I mean, what you're describing, the fans on board idea...
You're assuming fans ever had control. Can you tell me, since you don't do sport very often, when's the last time fans controlled football in this country? I mean, I'm intrigued by this.
Okay, so I would counter that. I would counter that Millwall fans used to control Millwall just by being so obnoxious.
My business partner, Women's Sports Group, is a woman called Heather Rabatz, who used to be chief executive of Millwall Football Club. And I don't think Heather's ever regarded the fans as being in control of Millwall Football Club. They might be in control of the terraces. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I'll ask her. But the fact is, you clearly have to have. I mean, where everyone, I mean, this is not exactly rocket science. You have got to have a move now towards, and this is not just in the Premier League, this is throughout the professional game. You've got to have the local populace, who are actually the ones who are going along to the games, buying tickets, buying merchandise, supporting the club. And the lower down the pyramid, the more important those fans are. They have got to have some say in the future of their club and the ownership of that club. Now, how you regulate that and structure that, we'll wait to see if there are any proposals on that that make any sense. I mean, it's interesting that the Tracy Crouch Commission has been, I mean, nobody knows who's on it. Nobody knows what it's going to do. Nobody knows when it's going to report, and nobody knows who it's actually going to get advice from. I mean, it's completely opaque. It was a good press release by Boris Johnson a couple of weeks ago at the height of all of this, but we've heard nothing since. But the idea that, so if you combine fans being on the boards of every club and a fit and proper person test that is regulated, so people actually have to justify their ownership of the club, and so it's not done by self-regulation, I think you go a long way towards getting, you know, much greater control over what's going on. And, you know, football has been allowed to self-regulate for far too long.
When take back control was famously raised as a slogan in the Brexit debate, it was also a myth that we ever had control, of course. One argument raised is over members, fans' ownership. I think there are sort of different examples you can use here. I think Barcelona has a membership structure and obviously was at the heart of the European Super League. But on the other hand, German clubs are often part owned by their fans and the local community, and they seemed much more reticent about the Super League project. So has that been a countervailing tendency in Germany? And there are some successful examples, I think, in the UK, Wimbledon, AFC Wimbledon, as being a fan-owned club. So maybe it's not the right recipe for everyone, but there must be scope for this as a model in English football too.
There is, absolutely. I mean, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, Germany, I think I'm saying it's 50+1. So actually German fans have a much stronger say in the run than almost anywhere else. And as far as I know, there is no German club that's owned by an overseas owner. I'm pretty sure is right. I think that's right. So, you know, that's, if you like, the opposite end of the extreme to what's happening here. And what's happened here is essentially being the Wild West. There it's a totally sort of almost self-regulated process by fans having membership. As I say, I'm in favour of fans having real voting board rights on football boards. I mean, I think it's the only thing you can do. And different clubs with a different sort of scale of, you know, activity can have different levels of representation. But I also think the ability to buy a football club in this country is sort of wide open. And that's because people think of this as being, you know, people standing around kicking a ball and people turning up to watch them. It's actually much more than that. It's much more than that. When a football club goes bust in Bury or in Wigan and can or cannot be saved, or indeed in many other places, that's a fundamental societal issue which we need to think about. And we need to think about both how it happened, and we need to think about regulation to prevent people being able to step in. The football authorities need to step in to save some of these clubs, because they're fundamentally part of the fabric, not just of football, but of society. And I don't think, actually, I've spoken to too many politicians on this subject in the last year within the Labour movement, none of whom kind of want to think about it. And I find this amazing, because to me, it's a huge political issue, not just a sporting issue.
Well, that takes us to our final question in the football segment. The government's promised a public inquiry. Can you expect anything good to come of that?
Well, as I said, you know, we're all waiting with, you know, to know who's on this inquiry, to know when it's going to report, to know how much knowledge it has. You forget, Tracy Crouch chaired an inquiry into football 4 years ago. People have completely forgotten this, which was, guess what, about fans' involvement in football clubs. It's really worth reading. And people who sat on her inquiry were the football authorities, the FA, the Premier League, and all the others. So guess what? They all promised to do better. And here we are. So forgive me for being a touch cynical, but, you know, Boris Johnson discovering football, when it now transpires that his chief of staff had met Ed Woodward of Manchester United only a week earlier, that's interesting. Anyway, he discovers football. He announces this inquiry with Tracy Crouch. Everybody in sport loves Tracy Crouch. That's terrific. And if it reports in 3 years' time, who cares? So it has to be quick. It has to be well-resourced. It has to be knowledgeable. And it has to be relatively radical. And we don't know any of those things at this stage.
And there was also a football governance inquiry in 2011, I believe. So it really is like the thing that keeps coming around. I think it was chaired by John Whittingdale at the time. Yeah, so I'm really interested in this argument about how this can be a marginal issue, which I think moves us on to talking about Labour and Labour politics. Because as you say, lots of these football clubs at risk, Bury's went into administration, as you said, not so long ago. These are in heartland red wall seats, so there's actually a story there about the decline of left behind Britain and how football stadiums at the heart and football clubs at the heart of that local community are struggling. So there's, you know, incredible potential, or rather necessity, for anyone who's serious about levelling up the UK to really talk about, well, levelling up football and investing in football and making sure that all those problems at that level of the game are resolved in one way or another. And a politician that's able to do that, you could imagine really in the run into the next election, would be maybe pretty confident of doing quite well in quite a lot of those seats.
I the first time I raised this was with Lisa Nandy during her leadership election campaign, and I told her Wigan Athletic was in trouble. And I said, this is a huge potential political uplift. If you believe in communities, look at the red wall seats and the football clubs in them. And I've said it to a variety of Labour politicians since, and not a single person, you are possibly the only person who's ever got the point. I find it absolutely infuriating, because when, you know, clubs start going bust, and they will, and their local MPs, and please God, some of them are Labour MPs, throw up their hands in horror, it will be because they didn't see, if you forgive the pun, the writing on the red wall. And, you know, if the local MPs are the Tory MPs, you can absolutely guarantee that there will be some sort of government intervention, just as there was with Football League. No coincidence. Do you think Boris Johnson really cares about Football League? Have a look at how much money has gone to Football League in the last year, and then look at where Football League, rugby league clubs are situated. You know, so I'm afraid but I think this is a really big, interesting political opportunity for Labour, you know, to focus on what is going on and to try and do something about it. But I'm afraid, Alison McGovern and I talked about this a bit. I mean, I'm afraid I can't seem to get any traction, but that is the story of the modern Labour leadership. You can't get traction with them on anything, in my experience.
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms, but the discussion isn't over. An extended version of the podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. It's a good chat if you want to listen to it. Just sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. You can join at anotheryourope.org/join. It doesn't cost much at all and makes a big difference.